gentlemen. Before we begin this morning, I want to announce that unfortunately Judge Kaney will not be able to be sitting here on the bench with us, but he does intend to listen to the recordings that we make of the arguments and will be participating in the decision of this case. So that is why you don't see him here, and we will proceed with Judge Tinder and myself. And we are ready for the first argument. United States against Glatfelter and others, 13-24-36, and numerous other docket numbers. Mr. Chesler.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Evan Chesler. I represent NCR. As the Court knows, we are appealing from the District Court's determination after trial that the harm here is not a divisible harm. When the Court entered a preliminary injunction in this matter back in April of 2012. The District Court stated, in its words, that the real harm in question is the cost of remediating the PCB problem. And the Court held then that my client had failed to prove divisibility because it had not shown that the cost of remediating the river would have been significantly different had NCR been the only contributor of PCBs to the river.
But, of course, now that we're here after a full trial and a permanent injunction, whatever tentative remarks were made at the preliminary injunction stage were all subject to correction. Don't you think the harm is the harm to the environment? And then there's a later question about whether there is not just a way to divide the costs. Of course, there's a way to divide the costs. You could flip coins. You could just do a pro rata. You could do all sorts of things. But a reasonable way to divide costs of redressing that harm is the question.
Your Honor, I agree that the harm here is the harm to the environment. The question is how you define it for purposes of determining divisibility. And there are lots of possible ways to do it. Now, what this Court said to us when we were here appealing from the preliminary injunction and we were sent back to have the trial to which Your Honor has just referred, this Court said the following. NCR did not put forth any evidence to refute the government's contention that NCR's contributions of PCB would alone require approximately the same remedial measures. Now, the fundamental, and that's what we went back to prove, Your Honor. And the fundamental problem here, and our fundamental point on appeal is this. When the District Court set about to determine whether this was a divisible harm, it applied a binary standard. The District Court said, there's either more than one part per million or less. If there's more than one, the river's contaminated in that place and the harm is done. And it's like the match has been lit and the building has burned down.
But, well, you don't have any disagreement with that, though, do you, the one part per million standard?
We have no disagreement with the one part per million standard, Your Honor. Here's where our disagreement is. When the government first put its record of decision in place in 2003, the original ROD, it, in fact, adopted precisely that legal standard, binary standard. There's either one PPM or there's not. And if there is, you dredge. And if there's not, you leave it alone. In 2007, the amended ROD was put in place. That was the rule, a set of rules under which we were sent back to try this case. And in that case, it is simply not true that every cubic yard of river is the same as every other cubic yard of river. It's if it's contaminated.
And I have
in
a
fact,
couple
they're dramatically different depending upon the particular circumstances of contamination. What's the density of PCBs in the location? What's the depth of the PCBs? Where is it in the river? And it was pursuant to those rules, which were not binary rules, that the definition of harm to the environment must then be interpreted, we submit.
Well, but wait a minute, Mr. Chesler. I'm one of the things that I'm concerned about at a very broad level with your argument is that I have the sense that it's blending the topic that we'll be discussing in the second case for this morning, the contribution topic, with the liability topic. It's certainly true we sent it back for a trial, and the district court heard quite a bit of evidence, the experts that you proffered, the experts that many other parties, particularly the government, proffered. And the district court concluded, if you want to call it in this binary sense, that the one part per million standard was met at the site, and I actually want to emphasize that the site is the whole 39 miles. It's not OU4 or, you know, operating unit, anything else. And so I don't see why the expert testimony on a clear error standard of review, which we now have since we have findings of fact, doesn't show that NCR is liable.
Your Honor, it's not a question of whether or not we're liable. We are liable. We've admitted that we're liable. The question is whether the harm for which we are liable is divisible or not.
Right, and the district court made extensive findings of fact that under the conditions of these discharges, this river, this situation, as I envision it, it's like somebody took an egg beater and just mixed up all of these PCBs, and then they precipitated on down, more so in slow-moving areas of the river than in fast-moving areas of the river, dredging from the Corps of Engineers, Sechet events, other sorts of things did have effects on where the PCBs wind up, but the district court finds that there's no principal basis, or that I'll be even more precise, that you didn't meet your burden of showing that there was a principal basis for dividing up the harm. You suggest pounds of PCBs, but the district court rejects that.
Your Honor, we originally...
Well, you have your little polygons. I know, I mean, yes, all sorts of things.
We were originally before the district court. We were talking about the amount of PCBs put in the river. That was what I was here before you in 2012 arguing.
I remember, actually.
I'm sure you do. as I'm sure you know that I remember it too. We were told then that that was the wrong issue. That the surrogate, and as this court said, in a complex situation such as this, this court said, we believe that cleanup costs may sometimes be a relevant factor for courts to use to determine the level of contamination, here are the key words, and thus the level of harm caused by each polluter. So we did go back and do exactly that, Your Honor. And again, it's not a question of whether we're liable. It's a question of whether that liability can be divided. And what we were told...
But why do you read in that sentence something stronger that says this is the only thing the district court can take into account, as opposed to what a full trial normally would be, like, you know, put all your evidence on the table, show us why it's divisible, and the district judge looks at it all and isn't persuaded that you've shown that.
Your Honor, if I can, I think the core of it is this, by analogy. It's not a question, we're not here challenging whether on a particular fact the judge said the fact is X and we think it should be Y and therefore is clear error. This is analogous to a situation in which the judge applied the wrong case when he looked at the facts.
So tell me, what did he do wrong?
He applied the case that says the standard, the legal standard that I'm to apply is whether this is below or above 1 ppm. Once I've decided that, I'm done.
Where do you see him saying that, though?
Your Honor, it's throughout the entire opinion. He says...
What, all 200 pages? I mean,
Your Honor, if he, for example, he says that once a cubic yard contains more than one part per million, it doesn't matter whether it's 1.5 or 35. He says that. In terms of remediation, the harm is the same.
There will have to be remediation. Now, of course, the type of remediation, as you rightly point out, it might be dredging, it might be capping, somebody might throw some sand on top of it. It might be different. But he says there will be some remediation.
Exactly.
And he's right about that.
He is. And in every divisibility case, Your Honor, every one, there is some remediation. The question is, how much is each party responsible for? And in this situation, it does make a difference. The judge is simply wrong, respectfully, to say, once I see that it's more than 1 ppm, the remediation must be done. It's a binary standard. That's the end of my analysis.
But let me ask you to think of this. Suppose we're looking at just one square meter of the bottom of the river. Let's make it an OU4, just to be realistic.
Yes.
And that square meter, let's say, has PCBs in the sediment going down 6 or 7 centimeters. Knowing whose PCBs contributed to that 6 or 7 centimeters, according to the testimony credited by the district court, is virtually impossible because of the way this all mixed up over time. So I'm not sure that the district court is wrong to say, even if you have different you know, depths, different concentrations, that that leads to a finding of divisibility.
Your Honor, but respectfully, I don't think that was that is what the district court held. What the district court held is the harm here is determined unilaterally once you've got more than one ppm per million. You have the harm, and that's not a divisible harm. That is not even a position for which the government contended here. The government never made the argument that, in fact, the standard is just whether it's 1 ppm or not. In fact, the government said in its post-trial papers, and I'm quoting, the PCB concentration trigger is more complicated and less dispositive than the Seventh Circuit's decision might suggest. So once you say, all right, let's take your example. I've got a certain number of parts per million of PCBs, and they're a certain depth below the surface of the sediment. What the rules that the government put in place in 2007 say is you then either put sand on it, you put a cement cap of some type on it, or you have to dredge it, depending upon where it is in the river, how many PCBs there are, and at what depth they are. And it is in that distinction that the binary standard was overcome by the multiple layers of remediation that the government imposed in 2007. And that's why I say the court looked at the wrong
legal standard. Right. I just am still having trouble finding, I mean, obviously there's a lot here. I'm happy to go back and look again. But
I'll give you a cite, Your Honor. A-123 to 124, which is from the district court's opinion, it says, because the need to remediate that parcel, a parcel which he says could have 1.1 ppm or 35 ppms in it, he says, because the need to remediate that parcel exists once that 1 ppm threshold is reached, even a very large increase in PCB concentration does not move the needle in making that area more harmful.
Right, and he's talking about Mr. Butler, but then he goes on to talk about a lot of other things about your why would he even bother to talk about the rest of the things if he wasn't taking all the facts into account? Later on, there's a section that talks about the complexity of the river. There's a great deal more than just that one quote.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but let me come to my last point because I see that I'm running out of time. What the court also completely ignored, and therefore there's not a factual error, but I believe an error of law in not considering the evidence, is that what the testimony showed is that even if the estimates that were made of NCR's contribution to the PCBs in the river were off by a factor of 2 or even a factor of 3, way, way more than the Burlington error margin that was assumed by the court there. If assuming, he said, suppose I'm wrong by 3 times, the divisible share is still half of what the company has already paid. Because under the rules that the government has imposed here, there's not a linear relationship between the concentration of PCBs and the cost of remediating it. You can have large variations where the cost remains the same once you've triggered some threshold for remediation. Lastly, Mr. Butler said, as an alternative, I'm going to rely upon the expert, which the district court never mentions. The district court says, I don't think the Simon team's work had, I said, I think it had flaws, so I think that therefore Butler is unreliable to the extent he relied upon it. The district court never even addresses the fact that Mr. Butler then took Wolf's analysis, which had nothing to do with the Simon analysis, was a completely different fate and transport analysis offered by one of our competitors, for which the government ceded 2 hours of its time at trial so Mr. Wolf could testify. And what that analysis showed, that if he used Wolf instead of Simon, our divisible share moved from 20% to 23.5%. The district court never mentions that. The district court had an obligation, I submit, to say, if I'm going to decide this can't be reasonably divided, I have to confront the evidence that was presented. I can't ignore it. And he criticizes Simon and never mentions Wolf. And in fact, the margin between the two is almost irrelevant. It's a 3.5% point difference.
Although he has made the preliminary finding that pounds of PCB contributed to the site, whether through NCR, whether through the recyclers of the broke, whether through the post-consumer people, are not at all linearly or in any other mathematical way related to the cleanup.
Exactly, and that's my point. That's
whole, why you
so then how have you proven divisibility?
Because
that's
because
the
when you apply
the
Your
facts
Honor,
of this case.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you. Because when you then apply the amended record of decision, which was the rule that was applied by the government to this case, you must then apply the remediation that those rules require, whether it's sanding, putting sand on top of it, or cement cap, or dredging. And when you do that, the costs vary dramatically, and within a particular bandwidth of a certain concentration at a certain depth, it doesn't matter. Once you have to adopt that particular form of remediation, then the cost will be the same. But as you move from one form of remediation to another, the costs vary dramatically, and the district court applied the standards that existed under the 2003 rules, not the 2007 rules.
I think the district court was saying whether there's 1, 25, 50, or more than that, you just can't say who is responsible for that accumulation.
And I believe, Your Honor, that is error. And when the district court, fails to consider the possibility, as the evidence showed, that even if those contribution percentages were off by a factor of 300%, it wouldn't have mattered to the share, and doesn't even address that evidence, that's error.
Okay.
Thank you.
Certainly. Mr. Mandelbaum?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is David Mandelbaum. I represent the P.H. Glatfelter Company. And I'll be speaking today also on behalf of the other OU1 defendants, WTM1 and Menasha. I want to talk about law, Your Honor. The injunction that was issued to the OU1 defendants is not supported by Section 106 of CERCLA. And the reason for that is that Section 106 of CERCLA has two distinct processes that it sets out for a governmental response to a threat from a release. The first is an emergency response that involves coming to court and getting an injunction.
So let me kind of cut to the quick here. If what you're doing is arguing that this shouldn't have been under 106B, it should have been under 106A, which does call for an equitable assessment, even if I were to agree with you that that's the correct way to do it, reading the district court opinion, I find everything there that would have been done if the district court had just cited the right statute, the right subsection of the statute. So why does an error in citation in this particular instance amount to a harmful error?
There are two reasons, Your Honor. First has to do with, as you say, the equitable factors, and I disagree, Your Honor, respectfully, that the district court considered everything that he might have considered. In his ruling on the pretrial motion in limine to determine the elements of the government's case, he specifically ruled that equitable factors would not be considered. And among the equities of this case are Whiting. Second, and more importantly, Your Honor, the time at which the facts are determined for purposes of deciding whether the remedy is required are different when it is enforcement of a UAO, which is by conventional enforcement, not by injunction. If the enforcement is of a UAO, which is the nuanced administrative expert response to a to a problem, the time under which the court evaluates the decision making of the agency is the time of the decision, and the review is deferential, but the agency doesn't get an injunction.
But here I'm looking at pages 66 and 67 of the opinion attached to your brief, and he writes, the parties agree that enforcement of a UAO is a kind of injunction, and then he goes on to cite the standard criteria for the award of permanent injunction, injunctive relief, success in the merits, no adequate remedy at law, irreparable harm without, and on, public interest, cites Old Republic, Monsanto, and Gerritsen Seed. So
that's an error, Your Honor.
That's where, well, I'm reading from the opinion. That's what the court says, and so I don't see why that passage of the opinion would have looked any different if the court had thought it was under 106A.
Because the court did not consider the fundamental question under 106A, of which elements of this injunction that the district court granted were necessary to abate the danger or threat as of the time of trial. There was the only evidence that was presented at trial was evidence of Dr. Waters. Dr. Waters read certain reports and opined that there were fish consumption advisories for fish in the Fox River, meaning that a few years before trial, 2011, I believe, is the date of the fish consumption advisories, that the fish contained too much PCB to eat an unlimited amount.
Right. So, and in fact, as the court relies on Dr. Waters' testimony, he's not speaking only in the past tense. He expressly says PCBs continue to cause health problems, continue to be washed into Green Bay, where they will never be able to be removed. You know, he looks ahead, so you can't say he doesn't say it. You might want to say, and I gather you are arguing, that the evidence to support that conclusion is weaker than you think it should be.
No, Your Honor, it's a different proposition.
You're not arguing
anywhere in the finding. Anywhere in the findings and anywhere in the record.
He says that there's a continuing harm, though. He at least thinks he's looking at.
Yes, but what he doesn't find, Your Honor, is he doesn't find that doing this, doing what he ordered, will accelerate or not accelerate the rate by which fish consumption advisories will be removed.
Why does he have to do that if he's just supporting the EPA's plan for remediation?
Because EPA does not get an injunction to enforce a UAO. What EPA gets is sanctions. It gets civil penalties or treble damages. If EPA wants to get an injunction, Your Honor, it must show its burden by a preponderance that the injunction is necessary to abate the danger or threat. That's the difference between 106A and 106B. What happened here was Congress established two separate ways of addressing a problem. One is an emergency way with an injunction, and the other is a nuanced administrative reaction. And what happened here was the district court put the two of them together.
I don't think I see them as quite as separate as you seem to see them. So you've conceded that the district court is looking at the present and the future. You've conceded that you're not arguing anything about the evidence from Dr. Waters or whatever. And what the district court is saying is, you know, there's been an extensive look, very extensive look, both in the 2003 ROD, the 2007 ROD, the various modifications, huge amount of industry input, and he's essentially saying the permanent injunctive relief that I'm giving is, you know, go forth and remediate, you know, as the EPA says.
He did not permit evidence, Your Honor, that remedy was not necessary.
But he might have thought, and we can consider this, that that's effectively asking, it's a backdoor way of asking EPA to reopen the 2007 ROD, and that's not something that's on the table right now.
Your Honor, I don't think EPA should reopen anything. I might believe that, but that's not in this proceeding.
We won't quote you.
That's not in this proceeding.
Okay.
What's in this proceeding is what relief does EPA get? And the relief that EPA gets, if it wants it, is an order in the event of a violation by any of the OU1 defendants that they owe civil penalties. And
it seems odd, you know, because that's actually pretty much what 106B does, in that if you, you know, you get an order, and then if you violate the order, you're in contempt of court. That's what happens with an injunction. We all know that. So I don't know why getting that order in place, which he's calling a permanent injunction, is so far afield from the statutory system.
There's no violation, Your Honor.
Well,
he didn't find a violation. In fact, he specifically agreed in his ruling on the motion, the pretrial motion, that there was not even an allegation of a violation. So the OU1 defendants haven't violated anything.
A violation as opposed to an act which triggers the duty under CERCLA to at least be in the pool of people who are jointly and severably liable for the cleanup.
That's correct. There's been no allegation.
You are in that pool.
Well, there's a separate issue that I want to address in a moment, Your Honor. But there's, there is no allegation that any of the OU1 defendants violated the unilateral administrative order. There's no proof of it, and there's no proof that any of the OU1 defendants have to be enjoined in order to reduce fish tissue concentrations more quickly.
So why do you care about this injunction? If all of it's the only thing it's doing is reciting what you agree you already know you have to do, and you also agree that if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you can be brought in on fines or monetary payments. What's the harm?
Well, Your Honor, it's like an injunction to obey the law. Right?
It's much more than that, of course, given your position about lots of other things. You were saying, you know, that as an OU1 person, you shouldn't have to have anything to do with OU4, for instance.
Let's turn to that.
It strikes me that there is something at stake.
Well, there is something at stake, but let me, that would be resolved as well by other forms of relief. An injunction puts the company and its executives at risk of contempt, and there's no way of knowing what's required of them because the district court hasn't assigned a specific obligation to the Gladfelter company. It's told four companies to go forth and do this job with a bunch
of
other...
Yeah, that's your Rule 65.
Yes. But let me turn, if you would, with your permission, to the issue of the liability of the OU1 defendants.
Sure.
OU1 itself is not part of this case because that was part of the OU1 consent decree case, U.S. v. Gladfelter. There was an attempt in 2007 by Gladfelter to litigate divisibility in that case, and Judge Adelman ruled that it could not be litigated in that case. So everyone agrees that this is the OU2 through 5 case.
Except that it's also the site. I mean, I guess I have a worry, which I've expressed elsewhere. Certainly for administrative convenience and because of the way the river happens to be, the EPA divided this site into the 5 operating units. And the little lake, which I always mispronounce because I think of it in French.
Butamore.
Butamore.
Okay. It's not French, it's Wisconsin.
Okay, Butamore. Okay. Little Lake Butamore. Now we have
the acronym Little Lake Hill of the Dead.
Yeah, in Indiana, we have Versailles as well. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there are lots of things like that. So anyway, we understand that lake is one thing, and as we go toward Green Bay, there are others. But it's really all one site. So why shouldn't that be something that we bear in mind?
Well, site, Your Honor, under this statute, site with a capital S is used only for only one place in this statute. There's a definition of on site. On-site is used only for the question of whether permits are required to conduct the remedial action. And the site, for that purpose, is everywhere that the contaminants happen to become located. The relevant question here is what is the facility from which there has been a release for which the defendants are liable. The allegation and the proof is that the facilities are the paper mills.
And they're up at Butamore.
They're up in Little Lake Butamore. So that the question is there a connection between the release from those facilities, which the defendants concede they're responsible for, and costs that are caused downstream?
Well, in other words, also, is there a connection between the release at Lake Butamore and Little Lake Butamore and the deposit of PCBs further in the direction of Green Bay? I guess that's downriver. Don't know it's up.
Yes, the language of the statute, Your Honor, is, and here the district court made a legal error. The statute requires that the release cause the incurrence of cost of response.
Right. So you have to imagine that these PCB globules attached to little tiny bits of sediments and whatever flow along in the fast parts of the river, the parts that are dredged, and then they come to this slow area, which is OU4, and they precipitate down to the bottom of the riverbed.
Most of them keep going.
Some of them precipitate down.
And the question is, Your Honor, whether that caused costs. That's the language of the statute.
Right. So did you add, and thinking of the precipitation, even if there was, say, 0.8 ppm in the sediment, if another 0.2 precipitates down and joins the 0.8, you now have the 1 ppm.
No, that's a fundamental factual error. Your Honor, the concentrations do not add.
But they, no. I think we have a real difference of opinion here, because certainly if you have a water-soluble substance, then if you pour two things into a larger tub, you're right. They're going to mix up. You're going to come up with an average. But if you have sediments, and it doesn't matter if there's a tiny bit of sediment in water or if there's a huge amount of sediment, once it precipitates down, it's not in the water anymore. It's just adding to what's at the bottom of the
Yes, Your Honor. The concentrations...
So the precipitate adds, even if concentrations blended don't.
It does not, Your Honor. Every expert who testified in this case says that it does not. And if you'll permit me, I'll explain it to you. The concentrations in the water column are much lower than all these part per million numbers we're talking about.
That's
the concentrations we're talking about are the concentrations that will be left in the sediment bed by the cloud of particles going past. Now, if you imagine that you have 0.8 in the sediment bed, if additional sediment particles precipitate out, they have a concentration on them. And either the two things layer on top of each other, right? So you get 0.8 and 0.2 on top of it, or they mix together, in which case you get between 0.2 and 0.8. We've done the math in the brief. We've cited to every expert, every single expert who was asked the question in this case testified to the contrary. The expert that the government called testified to the contrary. He had 1,000 ppm and a 0.5, and he did not end up with 1,000.5. He ended up with 3, right? So the fact of the matter is that concentrations don't add, they average, and that is an error that's embedded in the NCR divisibility proposition, and it's embedded in the presentation that the government's made. And because they don't add, the finding that the district court made that the OU1 defendants could be a necessary cause of cost downstream is simply incorrect.
Okay, well, obviously we'll look at the record since there are differences of opinion about this, I think.
Right. Your Honor, I think that even so, I also want to reiterate the point that the district court found that no nexus had to be proven by the United States. So there's a burden of proof issue. The government,
which has to be superimposed on the fact that this is a strict liability statute. This is not a statute that's just a reiteration of common law tort principles.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the United States can't prove that the Gladfelter Company is responsible for releases in OU1 and then hold it liable for every Superfund site everywhere.
Well, of course not. It's only this site, this 39-mile section of
I'll point out, Your Honor, that in the district court's ruling on summary judgment in the other case on the counterclaims, he specifically says it's merely an artifact that OU1 is part of this site. For a lot of purposes, it might as well be in New Jersey. So, you know, I think the conflation of the two or the combination of the various parts works both ways, and it's merely an artifact.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think you've both managed to save a little time for rebuttal, so we will await that and hear from Mr. Oakley.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Oakley. I'm here on behalf of the United States, arguing for appellees. Let me start with responding to the arguments by NCR on divisibility. The district court's opinion is much more nuanced than explained in the opening argument. The judge really did multiple things. He looked at the NCR argument on its face and found that there was a cascading effect of errors, starting with their estimates of how much PCBs were put into the river by the 10 dischargers, then going to the modeling, and then going finally to Mr. Butler's attempt to apportion harm.
So, Mr. Oakley, as you read the district court opinion, do you think the district judge is saying that this harm is not even theoretically divisible, or do you think the district judge is really saying that he thinks there's a failure of proof of divisibility, even though in theory it could be divided?
I think he's saying both. I think he was looking at the two-prong test that this court laid out in the preliminary injunction opinion, where the court said, although the ultimate question of whether the harm is theoretically capable of divisibility is a question of law, that there will necessarily be underlying factual determinations made which will be reviewed for clear error.
And well, of course, that was what, at least as I look at Burlington Northern, that's what the Supreme Court was doing. The Supreme Court in Burlington Northern says nobody was contesting whether there was theoretical capability of apportionment. So the opinion says the question is then whether the record provides a reasonable basis. That's why we said that.
And yes, and I think the district court judge tried to follow the court's lead here. I think you could move many of the factual determinations into the second prong of the case and say, look, it just doesn't work here because it's dependent, among other things, on knowing that NCR knows where a particular discharger's PCBs ended up, something that the district court judge said is simply impossible to do.
So what about NCR's argument? Essentially, what's so special about the Fox River? Aren't you saying that actually you'll never have divisibility in the case of river-based pollution?
Well, the government
surplus sites, I should say.
The government didn't say that, and the judge said that that was not essential to his finding, although it contributes, and that's why I think it's important to look at the judge's factual rulings, not one by one, up or down on that particular ruling, but combine them. And the combined uncertainty of the problems with Mr. Braithwaite's testimony and all the problems with that, Dr. Jones's modeling, Butler's testimony, and then the intervening cause problem of the river, which shows that PCBs, you have newer PCBs below older PCBs in parts of the sediment. That's why he ultimately concluded that you just can't apportion or divide the harm here on any kind of a reasonable basis.
So that depends on your definition of the harm. Actually, that's what Mr. Chesler was beginning with. You know, is the harm, if you think the harm is the cost of remediation, then areas where there's relatively cheaper remediation going on, throwing sand down or the fairly thin caps, is less expensive than the areas where you've actually got to get in there and dredge it out and take it off to some other disposal site and so on. So how do you think we should define harm?
I think the way that the district court defined harm is in terms of, is it contaminated or not, is in line with
the environmental harm.
Yes, the environmental harm, I think, is in line with your decision. Also, it encompasses a problem that the NCR model doesn't address, and that's what happens if you have you have causes that individually would not meet the one part per million level, but added together, and I don't want to get into the averaging versus adding. I'm just saying that NCR says it can trace PCBs to the point that it can say, okay, EPA found 1.5 PCBs parts per million in this particular polygon, and we can say 30% came from NCR, 20% came from another discharger. That's what they say they can do. I don't think they can, and the judge didn't either. But say they only find that everybody is below the one part per million individually, but when you add them up, you're over the one part per million. And you could do it even if you want to extend this on to the analysis that NCR had. What if you're at one level of remedial action, if you pull NCR's contributions out, and at another, if you add them back in? And then the problem of dealing with this is something which Mr. Butler just admitted he did not testify to, and the judge says several times, they just don't address the situation. Say, and I'm just to present it to you in the most simple way, a polygon where NCR contributed less than one part per million, but others put it over one part per million. Is NCR exempt from liability? You could very well end up with a situation of polygons where no one is liable, even though remediation had to take place because it was over the one part per million.
So this is all by way of your defense of the district judge saying it doesn't have to be a sufficient cause, it can also be a necessary cause.
Yes, and I think that's very much in the sense of the way Superfund was meant to work, because you have a harm, and it's also in line with the restatement, the examples of five or six people beating up another person, and how could you separate that out, and maybe none of them individually would cause the harm. And it's also like the examples that we discussed, I think, the preliminary injunction appeal. Two discharges of oil combined to set off a fire.
Many of these discussions caused me to think that the restatement desperately needs to move into the 21st century with its with its examples. Cows drinking poisoned water and stuff seemed.
Yes, unfortunately, we don't. Most of us don't have to deal with cows. But to be clear, I think the judge really did it both ways. He gave NCR the benefit of the doubt and said, looked at their testimony. He looked at it very carefully. He doesn't say, this is worthless. I'm not going to
consider. What about Mr. Wolf's testimony, which was one of the points
raised? Mr. Wolf is really, they're reading Mr. Wolf's testimony for more than it's meant to, as we point out in our brief. Mr. Wolf never said use his transport and fate model. He didn't think it was adequate himself. They are using Mr. Wolf more for estimates and their various estimates of how much mass of PCBs NCR put in the river. And the judge said in his first opinion, and I think it seems to be accepted by the parties in this appeal, that mass simply does not equal a basis or does not provide a basis for harm because of the mixture. So that some party might put in a great deal and cause relatively little harm, and others might put in a smaller amount.
Fundamental point, as I understand it, is that if, as in the case of some of these restatement examples, you could construct, I'll just call it a predictable relationship. I'm not sure it needs to be a linear relationship, but a predictable relation between a factor that we can measure, such as poundage or square, cubic feet of water or something. I mean, if we could relate that to the remediation, then we would have a solid basis for divisibility. But your position, as I understand it, is that no one has shown how to relate poundage to divisibility.
That's correct.
Or anything else, for that matter.
They have not, because there's discharges at different locations. And it's along a 39-mile stretch of river, so that there are obvious problems there. I don't see an argument, serious argument, by NCR or any of the other parties that if we knew, even with greater exactness than we do or could, exactly how much everybody put in the river, that would be a way, that's how we should divide up the harm in a CERCLA divisibility case.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you don't want to get into this adding or averaging notion, but you agree that the concentrations average rather than add. Do you agree with that?
I agree with it, but I think there's just some confusion as to what the judge was saying.
And that's what I wanted to get at. Point us to where we can realize the judge understood the effect of the additional harms that the varying activities had.
As I stand here, I'm afraid I cannot give you a smoking gun citation on that. But the way he talks about it, he's always talking about the harm in the polygons. And so that's after all the averaging, whatever has taken place. And most of this discussion is in response to NCR, because NCR developed the most sophisticated argument on divisibility in the case. So he's not saying, okay, so there's some water containing parts, let's say, 0.010 parts per million, and I'm going to add that to other water containing 10 parts per million to get to 0.20 parts per million. He's talking about NCR's model, which asserted it could tell you how many, what percentage of parts per million that were in the sediments.
So they start with the sediment, and they say it has 2 parts per million. And
yes,
we can tell you of that 2 parts per million, how much came from Glatfelter and how much came, or at least the Butamore defendants, something that, like that. So in a sense, the how it got there part, you're arguing anyway, isn't necessary.
Well, addressing the concentrations that produced in the sediments, either certain parts per million of PCBs, is not relevant. I mean, whether the NCR met its burden to show that they could fingerprint or trace everybody's PCBs to a polygon, I think that's a different question. It
so
is
we
relevant.
We have evidence, I guess, about how much gets released from the various facilities. And we have evidence of what's in each polygon on the site, in each of these operating units, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And at that point, the question is, can we relate the one to the other, I guess?
I think the best refutation of that is if you look at the judge's analysis of the expert, I think he was offered on behalf of Glatfelter, and certainly on the OU1 defendants, that's Dr. Magar. And the problem that he had, or that the judge rather had with that expert's testimony, is that you would assume a gradual diminution. And so that in certain areas, for example, take OU3, there are no dischargers in OU3. There should the amount of PCB should be significantly less than OU2. Now, OU2, though, is odd. There's a graph in the judge's opinion that shows that I think it actually, over a course of miles, the river drops as much as Niagara Falls. So that's a fairly fast-moving unit. And so, in fact, you find that there are significant parts of PCBs in OU3 where there's no discharger. Similarly, at the top of OU4, there are significant deposits of PCBs, and now you have added NCR into the mix at the top of OC4. OU4, but you have not added the dischargers in OU4 at that point. So this is like the NCR modeling expert, Dr. Jones. This is a problem with reality not conforming to modeling.
Right, the model predicted that they'd be someplace, and they, in fact, weren't where the model said, and they were, in fact, in these other places. I remember that argument. Before you run out of time...
Let me ask about that, too. Is that characteristic something... unique or unusual for PCBs, that the way they travel, the way they attach and so forth, is almost defies prediction?
It's a difficult prediction. I, as a former English major, I'm not going to be great on the science on this, but I know one of the questions here is, so the PCBs come out and they tend to attach to solids.
Very small.
And they can be
solids,
very fine.
Is what
solids,
I thought, right. Fine
but
sediment.
Then what happens if they detach or deabsorb? And there is a technical dispute here. Do they keep going until they get out to Green Bay where there's really very little, that's OU5 and there'll be very little remediation there? Or are they showing up elsewhere?
Do they resorb into
the court found that the experts were more credible, that it was saying that there was at least some reabsorption so that these could, in effect, attach, deabsorb, and reattach, or desorb. I'm sorry, I'm not even sure the right word to use there. Let's just stick with reattach. And again, the judge looked at this very carefully and judiciously. You know, he didn't say that, and we're not saying that NCR's experts are completely crazy or anything like that. But the judge recognized too that he couldn't just say, "Well, this is a complicated business. I can't figure it out. I'm going for the government." He said again the cascading impact of the errors and uncertainties, and the problem of intervening cause, and the problem of a harm that is necessary but may not be sufficient by itself to cause remediation. All of this made the NCR model fail. And the Glatfelter argument as well.
So that I wanted not to overlook the Glatfelter part of the appeal. And so that, I think, addresses part of the question whether the OU1 defendants as a group should have anything to do with OU4 or not. You know, there's an evidentiary question whether there's evidence in the record to support, you know, the movement of the PCBs down the river. There is also this point about 106A and 106B, and actually a point of, maybe I'll have you start at the back end. I am concerned with the Rule 65D point, because we've said more than once that if there's going to be an injunction, it's got to be a self-contained document, because injunctions, as you well know, are punishable by contempt. You can't say to somebody, here's some vague standard and we're going to haul you into court on contempt. So maybe you could talk about that a little.
Well, I would make, my responses would be largely governed by the court's decision in the Apex Oil case. First, we would certainly agree that we cannot haul anybody into court on a vague standard and get contempt penalties about them, and that if any of the parties who are enjoined now or in the future, in this case, find themselves getting directions from EPA that they think are just wrong, that exceed what needs to be done, they can go to the district court and seek relief.
So are you arguing, I mean, actually, as an old antitrust lawyer, I'm reminded of things like the modified final judgment, where there were rather broad standards issued. Maybe you don't remember that, but it existed for quite a while, and Judge Harold Green ran the telecommunications industry in the country under it. But people would go to the court first for clarification of what their responsibilities were, and then afterwards, of course, if they didn't abide by those responsibilities, contempt was possible.
And I don't see why that wouldn't apply here.
Well, the reason to argue against myself is Rule 65D. The injunction is supposed to describe in reasonable detail, not by reference to other documents, the act or acts restrained or required.
Well, and it seems to me what this court said in Apex Oil applies, where the court said in that case, which while it wasn't a Superfund case, it was a RCRA case, did involve a cleanup, that, quote, to specify the details of the project in the decree would either impose impossible rigidity on the performance of the cleanup or more likely require constant recourse to the district judge for interpretation or modification of the decree. I think given of the complexity of a Superfund cleanup, it just couldn't be written out in that level of detail. And let me just go back to something that came up in the appellant's part of the argument. EPA was willing to reconsider its 2003 remedy when the recipients of the UAO order came to them and said, look, we think we can provide safety at less cost by instituting more capping and less dredging. And so they issued the 2007 ROD, and I think the government doesn't get any benefit of just ranking money for no good reason out of the defendants, and that it's shown that by the amended ROD, which allowed a great more amount of capping here.
So are you arguing, I can imagine that there could be a be careful what you wish for scenario here if the injunction itself spelled out every last detail from the 2007 ROD as explained later on in 2010, there might be more rigidity to it than if EPA is constantly, and for that matter, whatever they're doing, WDNR, constantly fine-tuning. So I don't know if that's a point you're making.
I think that is a problem, and that problem can go both ways, to be fair. I would hope at this late date it's unlikely that the agency will suddenly discover a significant deposit of PCBs in the river where it was believed there were none before, and therefore the costs are going to go up significantly to address this new area. But I can't say that that's impossible. So it would both, I think, limit EPA. It could hurt both sides if we had at this date in the remedy just line by line, polygon by polygon instructions as to what to do.
So what about 106? It did seem that this wasn't the greatest fit for 106B.
I think that the real dispute on the 106B versus 106A issue, and I think this came through in the appellant's argument on this point, it's really whether what should be the standard of review for the agency's remedy in the context of getting an injunction. And what they said, and they repeated it today, they wanted to do, is to apply equitable principles, not the arbitrary and capricious standard that Section 113 of the statute says should apply to a judge reviewing a remedy, but equitable principles. So the EPA would have to come in and prove, well, this is exactly the level, we can say with absolute certainty, this is the level of remedial work that has to be done to protect people. And I think, as opposed to if there were, as there has been in this case, a challenge to the remedy where they just have to show that they're not arbitrary and capricious. And I think it would be inconsistent with the statutory scheme if because we're seeking an injunction, the court would have to carefully review and give the agency no deference, and have a de novo trial to determine, okay, what's the just perfect balance here? Protection to the public on the one hand and cost to the defendants on the other. And that's really what's driving this whole otherwise a seemingly pedantic discussion, because you'd have a very different trial if it were de novo and where the judge was looking for that magic point of what to hit. And he, I think, you know, in his decision, and he was criticized by some of the appellants, but he made the very reasonable point in his decision now on the remedy that evaluating these things requires a lot of expertise that most judges simply don't have. And at least he was willing to acknowledge, although he's obviously an intelligent person and has written very thoughtful decisions, that he doesn't have the background in chemistry, fate and transport, etc., to make these evaluations, and that it's appropriate to defer to the agency. And I think that's really the answer to the 106 argument.
So do you see any issue under the statute about the authority of the United States to come in and get an injunction that backs up an ROD?
I know that, and I'm sorry I'm blanking on the case name. I believe we cited in our briefs there is a Seventh Circuit decision that says the court can issue an injunction under 106A. There is a somewhat different opinion in the First Circuit in the Atati and Goss decision. Mm-hmm. And being in the Seventh Circuit, we understandably went with the Seventh Circuit's read here. And whether it's B or A, I think the key thing is, did he consider the traditional factors, and did he do so in the right context? And that he did so in terms of evaluating the remedy with reference to the arbitrary and capricious standard, I think was exactly correct under the statute. If the court has no more questions, I'll just sit down. Anything else?
Anything else? Apparently not. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Chesler? I'm sure the answer is yes.
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct.
Obviously, I will be as brief as I can and within the amount of time allotted. Your Honor, I want to come back. I believe I heard counsel for the government say that in answer to one of your questions that he believed the district court did conclude that this was not a harm that was capable, theoretically capable of being divided.
Yeah, I think he said that it was both.
It was both. Yeah. Therefore, that it was also not theoretically capable.
Right, right.
And the way the district court did that was by applying this binary standard that I referred to before. Indeed, the district court says, one point in its opinion, at A143, that in order to prove divisibility, Mr. Butler had to show that there would be specific areas in the river where the contamination would be less than 1 ppm in an NCR-only scenario, but where it would exceed that level when the discharges of the other PRPs are added in. That is the binary standard. Respectfully, he asked the wrong question. He applied the legal standard that existed under the 2003 ROD, not under the 07 amended ROD, because in the world in which we were sent back to try this case, and for which my client is paying all of the bills, the subject we'll come to in a bit today, They are governed by a definition of harm that says the harm varies, the cost of repairing it varies. And therefore, the harm is not binary. Within the world in which there's more than one PPM, there are different harms depending upon how many there are, where, how deep they are, and where they are. And that affects the cost of remediation. And what Mr. Butler did was this. He said, I'm going to take the government's concentration data, I'm going to take the government's rules of remediation, and I'm going to take the actual costs of fixing this. And the one variable I don't have and I'm going to come up with is, how much did each of these people put in to contribute to that concentration? The cascade of errors to which counsel referred, if you read the opinions, I'm sure you have and you will, refer exclusively to the Simon team's work. He never analyzed the effect of using Wolf. And indeed, counsel stood here and told you correctly, Wolf, although he was obviously testifying in ways that were different from what we said and came to some different conclusions, said, I can, in fact, estimate how many PCBs NCR put in. I can do that. Okay?
But can you estimate where NCR's PCBs landed, ultimately, as opposed to anybody else's PCBs?
Yes,
I don't see how you can.
Once
they've all mixed up. I mean, I've seen Butler's testimony. I looked at the bit about Wolf. I looked at the district judge's criticisms.
Right.
And I'm not sure, actually, at the most fundamental level, that at the full trial, the judge is defining harm the way you are. That's why I asked Mr. Oakley, you know, what's the government's definition of harm?
Right, right. And I believe he did define it, as we said, because we had originally said it's quantum of contribution. He said, no, it's cost. We came here and said it's quantum. This court said, no, in this case, it could be cost. We went back and did it religiously according to the rules of how much this costs to fix. And by the way, he demonstrated both that NCR alone was not sufficient and that NCR was not necessary, because he did the all but NCR analysis. He said, suppose everybody else had put the PCBs in that they had and NCR hadn't. The cost of remediation would have been almost identical to what it turned out to be. In
but
his case, about 97%.
If you accept all of the things Mr. Butler said, I couldn't disagree with you. But the district judge actually has a lot of criticism for the methodologies and the applications.
He does. And I say one last time, I guess my time is just about up, all of this cascade of error analysis that he gave was based upon the Simon analysis, not Wolf. I urge you to look at what Mr. Wolf said about his ability to estimate what our contribution was. And Butler, using that data, says it doesn't matter, because when you apply the rules of remediation, it moves our contribution by 3.5%. And lastly, Your Honor, the government's own representative, Wendy Carney, who's the EPA's deputy director for the Great Lakes National Program, testified, this is in the transcript of December 3rd, 2012, transcript 69. She testified that it was never the EPA's position that the river was too difficult or too complex or too dynamic to understand.
Okay.
And the government stood here at the last argument and said, this is just like every other river. There's no difference between this river and another. And lastly...
All right. This really is last.
Lastly, the government used a model very similar to Mr. Jones in order to model the river in the first place, so it must be theoretically capable of divisibility.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Mandelbaum.
Thank you, Your Honor. I've been accused of pedantry, so I have to come back.
Pedantry at the court. Don't worry about it.
I want to start with Rule 65. Mr. Oakley talks about the need to have flexibility in deciding what must be done as a whole. I want to come back to that in a second when I talk about 106. But there's another problem here that's very important to the OU1 defendants, which is who has to pay what? So there are four parties that are enjoined, several parties that have entered into stipulations.
Well, don't you mean who's liable for what? Because we are, of course, about to get in the next case to who actually is paying for what.
What does the injunction require, not of the group of parties that are enjoined, but of the Gladfelter company specifically? Rule 65 requires that to be clear, and it's not.
Isn't it clear that it's joint and several liability?
Yes, but tomorrow, when NCR is solvent and the Gladfelter company is solvent, and so is Menasha Corporation, WTM, not so much.
Actually, not so much, right.
Right. Who puts in what to fund the first months of the 2014 project?
Well, if that happens, I don't see why there can't be, you know, further discussion about contribution. I mean, I don't see why that has anything to do if you know you're jointly and severally liable. There certainly is an issue that courts have struggled with about the degree of detail that regulatory injunctions, which I'll lump a lot of things under, need to have, because it's a little bit hard to say stop trespassing on Jones's land if actually you're talking about cleaning up a Superfund site or, for that matter, regulating telecommunications.
Apex addresses the question of whether you can have, you're allowed to have flexibility in embedded in an injunction with respect to what the work is. But Apex is a single party case. And that's not, it's not the same case when you talk about a multiple party case.
But if you know you're jointly and severally liable, the answer should be fairly simple. You're potentially on the hook for the whole thing.
Yes, but there's a question of what actually has to happen in real time. These parties have been jointly and severally liable. Each of them understand it under the UAO since 2007, and we've had a lot of litigation. In fact, we had litigation in this very case after the injunction was issued, after the rulings have been made in the Whiting case, and yet there was further motions practiced to try to get each party to pay. NCR brought a motion to get each party to pay 25%. And the judge didn't say what the shares were. He just said none of the private parties get to start a claim to determine that. So it is not an injunction that any one of us here in this room can advise our client with perfect certainty as to what is required tomorrow. There's further litigation that's required.
I'll let you have one more sentence.
All right. The nuanced approach to cleanup is to use the administrative process and the UAO, not an injunction. An injunction is a blunt instrument. So by conflating the two, we find ourselves both in the 106 problem and in the Rule 65 problem. The parties here are all jointly and severally liable under the UAO, and the legal issues should be tested in conventional enforcement, not an injunction. No one's trying to undo the remedy here. We're saying that an injunction has not been proven. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. We will take this case under advisement.